welcome to With All Due Respect by Eternity News. It's great to have you, where we discuss the big topics with grace. And I'm here. My name's Michael Jensen. And
I'm Megan Powell Dutoit.
And look, it's been a bit of a dog of a year, as many people have said, 2020. And so we're going to look back over it, it being the end of 2020. What a year, or what it felt like at times. It was a century all of its own. We had fires, we had COVID, we had the US election, we had more COVID, then we had more COVID. We talked to demographer Mark McCrindle about societal and church trends over the year. And Megan and I then chat about what we as Christian leaders think this will mean for the church in 2021 and beyond. And we share our favorite cultural moments of the year, something to do on the beach or over the Christmas holidays, book, TV, and film.
Be our guest, opening up the conversation to others. Mark McCrindle is a sought-after demographer, futurist, and social commentator. A Christian, he heads up McCrindle Research, which is a social and market trends research firm. Everyone, I think, has been wanting to talk to him about what's been going on with 2020.
But we are.
We are. So we've brought him on so that we can talk about what's happened during this year. Welcome, Mark. It's great to have you on.
Great to be with you. Thanks so much.
Well, what we want to do is we want to look at some facts or some statistics that you, I think, have researched, and they're all available on your website, on your blog. And we'll look at what they mean for the future of Australian society, but particularly for the church. So the first one that we noticed was about uncertainty, that 2 in 5 people feel extremely or very uncertain about the future since the outbreak of the virus, while another 52% feel somewhat or slightly uncertain. Is that continuing as we go further into COVID? And what do you think that says for us?
Yes, well, it's starting to wane, those negative sentiments. You know, we found the top three that have dominated this year have been anxiety, uncertainty, and frustration. You know, that's been the dominant response of Australians, and understandably, in this crazy year. In fact, more than half of Australians, 57%, say that this has been the most difficult year of their life.
Wow.
So, you know, incredible findings there and I guess challenges, but on the positive side, how we as Australians have got through it, particularly compared to other countries.
Yes.
And, you know, our responsibility, our civic duty, our compliance with rules. Mm. I mean, it's been quite remarkable, particularly compared to other nations. And I think that's how we have got through so well.
So you're thinking that people are perhaps feeling less uncertain than they were at this end of the year, that that's tailing off somewhat?
Exactly. When we first ran this study in April, and, you know, wow, they were dark days back then. Mm. We didn't know where this was going. We were watching the daily numbers of COVID rise. We had those sentiments were the top ones. Number 5 on the list was hopeful. So there was a little bit of hope there. Mm. Number 5 rose by the time we were in the middle of the year, and this was just before we saw the second outbreak in Victoria. And, right. And hopeful had risen to number 2 on the list, so it was rising up, and it's now the number 1 sentiment of Australians. So we have, you know, literally ridden the roller coaster of the waves, and we are feeling hopeful once more as the dominant response.
What kind of behaviours do you see coming out of those different stats? So, what does uncertainty and anxiety, what do they drive in terms of the way we behave? And then again, what does hope drive? Do we see that coming out in economic things, economic stats, or other social data?
Mm, yeah, we sure do. You know, sentiment then plays out in our behaviours, and that's why, you know, we see consumer sentiment indexes and business sentiment, because people aren't going to spend if they feel uncertain. It has broad impacts even beyond that. For example, the fertility rates drop in uncertain times. Mm. We've seen this in previous recessions and in the depression of old and the war years, and we're on that same curve. The fertility rate is dropping in Australia. People talk, there might be a whole generation of, I think they were calling them COVIDians, these COVID babies in lockdown. Actually, the opposite. Fewer births this year. And
lots of puppies, though. I noticed lots of puppies.
Yeah, well, that's right. Yeah, so, you know, we need some relatable, you know, connections in the household in lockdowns. But, you know, it does, a sentiment and an attitude, a perception has a very tangible outcome in terms of behaviour. And on the positive side, as we move more now to a sense of hopefulness, Australians will start to get out a little bit more and will start to adjust to perhaps this new normal, but nonetheless, it does have positive outcomes in behaviour.
So the second area we wanted to look at was the way in which we've had to rethink the way we gather for work and for other things. So many people are still working from home, and I've talked to people who've told me definitely they're not going back to the office. 7 in 10, so 70% have revealed that they're in no rush to get back to their workplace gatherings in the way that it once was. I talked to one guy in my parish whose job it was to do sort of office space architecture inside. Not a good business.
No, not a good business.
And interestingly, in the church, we've seen the same. And so, in my church, most people have started to trickle back, but there's still some people who are definitely kind of, no, I'm not coming. You know, I'm enjoying watching things at home. And you've said here, 53% of people want to keep online services running. What do you see happening in this area?
Well, and it's right, I think, to look at those two aspects, our attitude to heading back to the workplace and our attitude to heading back to church and the place of gathering there, because there are a lot of similarities. On the work side, you're right. You know, we found that 3 in 4 now say work from home is going to be part of the ongoing future. We actually broke it down. You've got about 25% of workers who say they want to get back to how it was, everyone in the office all of the time. And you've got about 14% saying we want to continue as we were in the heat of the lockdown, everyone working from home all of the time. But the bulk, 62%, fall into this hybrid mindset that they want some time in the workplace and some time at home, because we need those social connections as we gather in a workplace. And we also found the benefit of cutting down some commute time and just some of the productivity of working from home. So hybrid is the expectation for the future of work, and many are saying that they'll experience that in church. It does make it difficult for parishioners, Michael, you'd see it as from the clergy side as well, to be able to or have to run both, you know, an online service and also, you know, cater for those in the building. But that's what Australians want, the ability to tap into church online if, for example, the child is sick or for mobility issues or maybe older people, but also just because they saw how many people could attend, how you'd send a link and invite someone who would never walk in the doors of a church, and there they were, they see the opportunities of that for connecting with others.
So that flexibility is possibly a really positive thing in both church and in work.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, we've seen it with a lot of these programs that we thought, you know, would never work in a virtual sense. You know, Alpha, one of those programs as people explore Christianity, lots of Bible studies, these sorts of things. And you think, well, how can it work online? Because we need to gather and look each other in the eye and share a cuppa together and connect. But actually, they have been working. In fact, I was talking to one church leader, and he said that they're getting a lot of the Zacchaeuses turning up, which is, he said, people who want to see Jesus but don't want Jesus to see them, you know, and they sort of tune in with the camera off and they stay anonymous. And wow, how awesome to allow people to explore issues of faith without the intimidation of having to walk into a building, to a whole new sort of religious culture. They can explore from the fringes. And I think that's one of the great benefits of church going digital.
Yeah, it has been like a maturing into the digital space that's sort of been accelerated, hasn't it, through COVID? Well, I want to see what you thought about the next fact, which was that, and I think you already mentioned this, and I find it really intriguing comparing this with what's been going on in, say, places like the US, that 9 in 10 Aussies agree that they're actively listening and following messages of health experts and government officials, with a further 89% willing to reduce their personal freedoms for the sake of community health, which has been, I think, an astonishing difference here. And what do you think that's meant for our community as a whole?
Well, it's definitely helped us get through the worst of this. And this probably was the biggest surprise for me in this research. You know, we think about Australians as being anti-authority. We're skeptical of government and rules and authority figures. We like to push back a little on that. Well, actually, we've behaved more like Singaporeans in this time. You know, we've been very compliant, following all the directions. In fact, if you look at our results and how we've gone in this COVID, we've actually out-Singapored Singapore, which is pretty impressive. What? And it's interesting because prior to this, we were in a time where there were social influencers and people getting up and sharing their perspective. You know, forget the scientists. Here's what I found. Here's my remedy, or here's what I believe about this whole thing. And that all got pushed to the side. The number one source of advice for Australians we found in our research was official health advice, was the government advice. Mm. I mean, remember back to March, even before the restrictions came into place, Australians were starting to lock themselves down and not go out as much. Mm. And now we're sort of past the worst of it. The government's in most states are saying, okay, you can come out here, let's sort of go to cafes, here's a voucher, you know, please come out, we need to get the economy going. And people are saying, well, just slow down a little, you know. So Aussies have taken this very seriously, and it's the civil approach to this, and I think the compliance and how we've managed as a society to remain so, I guess, well-behaved in it all, mm-hmm. That has led to a great health outcome and I think, you know, a great community outcome as well.
And you're seeing that with the church as well, and that we just really didn't have major church leaders or some of the really big churches trying to say, look, you know, you're getting in our way, our religious freedom. There's been a little bit of that, but on the whole, the church has been quite cooperative as well.
And I think this did rattle us as a nation when it came around and we saw it come to our borders. And we probably do have a little bit of that island nation sort of mindset that actually we've got a chance to make the most of this because we do have blessings that other places don't have with no contiguous borders. Mm. And so if we have, if you like, almost a responsibility to use the best of what we've got to get through and maybe, you know, set an example for other nations. And we've done that well. And you're right. You know, people, we all love our freedom and people value their independence and their religious freedoms. But I think people were able to balance that with the health need, with the vulnerability of others, mm. and to say, look, I'll give up some of my freedoms and I'll trust the government. You know, as long as they're being open and transparent and giving us a way forward, we will trust that and temporarily put our freedoms on hold for the sake of the outcome. And I think the trust on both sides, the government have fulfilled that at different levels, and the people are now seeing the outcomes of it.
Now, what about relationships? So 2 in 5 Australians you found have, for 42%, have experienced tension in their most significant relationships. On the other hand, 4 in 5 agree that COVID-19 is positively strengthening their family and household. They have 79% of those. Well, about the same number feel that COVID has clarified the relationships within they want to invest their time. So, I mean, I knew families where in the midst of lockdown, it was extremely tense. You had mum, dad working at home and you had kids trying to do Zoom. You had not enough bandwidth and everyone was looking a little bit frazzled. But over the long term, it's a much more mixed picture. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. You know, these were, you know, unique times with everyone all of a sudden doing a lot more in the home than they were used to. Not just dormitories anymore. Our homes were schools and they were workplaces and just a lot of activity. And so you'd expect a bit of friction and tension in all of that time. And there was no escaping it on day, night, or weekend. There we all were together. But I think that the group that's in the, hey, we experience tension in our relationships, and the group that experienced strengthening may well be the same group, you know, because we know that when we have those issues we have to resolve, it does lead to a strengthening of relationships. Being forced to spend more time together means that we can't brush those things under the carpet or keep a little bit of passive aggression there because we've got to front deal with it. We can't just escape to work each day. And this wasn't the case in every situation, of course, but I think it did get Australians to reorder, you know, what's important to me, and you know what family is, and solving these relationship issues is, and maybe a bit of gardening and a bit of, you know, sourdough baking and the slower pace of life is maybe more beneficial long-term than just chasing the next thing. So that's one of the key outcomes that came for Australians through COVID.
Well, I just want to finish with one sort of set of connected stats, really about, because you're saying people are thinking more about the relationships, people have actually been having a more spiritual thought process as well. So, you know, you found that about 1 in 2 Australians have thought about the mortality more, similar proportion have thought about the meaning of life more, 3 in 10 have thought more about God. And then when you looked at Christians, that actually, a lot of pastors, I think, were really concerned, but that 74% have found more overall spiritual growth and 84% are taking more responsibility for their own spiritual growth. So the really interesting spiritual outcomes from the COVID crisis.
It's phenomenal. It's phenomenal, Megan. And those you know, stats you were just sharing, you know, that's the broader community, as you said. You know, that 28% of Australians say that they prayed more during COVID. And, and keep in mind that only about half that proportion, about 14-15%, go to church regularly. So actually, tough times, and again, we see this historically, do cause people to look beyond just the temporal for the spiritual, for something beyond themselves. They do think about their life and what comes after. And we've seen that clearly in this time as well. People looking for something a bit more solid in a world of shifting sands, and the spiritual has been a key area of output there. I mean, keep in mind the mental health issues we've had as a nation in this time, the uncertainty. I mean, as I was sharing earlier, the anxiety and frustration, and people do look to something beyond themselves at this time. And we're seeing that in even people clicking onto church and again, other spiritual outcomes that might give some direction in life.
Well, thank you so much for being with us and sharing that that research, all that hard work you've been doing. You've obviously been very busy during COVID-19 in 2020, and it's really insightful for us, and I know for our listeners too. We'll be fascinated to hear what you've shared with us. So thank you once again for joining us, Mark.
Thanks, Mark.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks, Megan. Thanks, Michael. Appreciate it.
See you. Still to come, the return of the segment In Our Humble Opinions. I think the word humble is slightly ironic there. In which we give our take on a situation and what we would do this time, the changed COVID world. And then Marg and Dave with a twist, our number ones for the year.
I just want to share with you a really great initiative. We're partnering with Anglican Aid at the moment, and they have a new program, kind of like, you know, your sponsor a child, but this is sponsor a Bible college student, both women and men, and it's helping them to be theologically educated in their own context. And this is something that you might want to look at doing as, say, like a church or a Bible study group or whatever you call it, because it supports a student to study at your Bible colleges in Egypt or Kathmandu or Tanzania. So it's really good value.
I mean, I know we both really value our theological education. We see the benefit to the church that comes from having well-trained laymen and women and leaders. And we know that that's really important to the health of God's people across the globe. So it's a really significant thing that we can be doing to support people to get trained in their own cultures in ways that are culturally appropriate. It's a fantastic project, and you can find out more at anglicanaid.org.au. In our humble opinions, or what would we do? It's so helpful to get the input of a social researcher like Mark McCrindle with all that research background. But how do we take these trends and changes and connect them to our faith and practice as the church? What are the challenges and opportunities in our views as Christian leaders? We've talked about anxiety and uncertainty, new church patterns, relationships, community and society, and what the year ahead holds. What do you reckon, Megan?
I think particularly some of the new stats that are just coming out that Mark was talking to us about there, I think it's going to be really interesting that this has been a sort of a generational changing event. I think it's certainly going to change my kids' generation, a very significant event. But I think for all of us, it's a moment of rethinking as a society, but also I think as the church. I think it's given us a chance to kind of go, is business as usual really what we want to be doing?
No, I mean, this has been, I'm running a church community.
Yeah.
And so we're trying to engage with this. And all of a sudden, for instance, we were thinking we have to change what we measure. So we used to have the sort of batting average as a church is your average weekly attendance.
Who attends, yeah.
This is the rector's obsession, the pastor's obsession. And we really can't do that now because we're actually engaging with people through the week in many different ways. People are coming to small groups and not on Sunday. People are coming, engaging with us online. And so a much better measure, or more measures of what we do, we need to look at more things because we're doing more. We're actually doing more things. And it helps us also to spread what we're doing across different platforms and engaging with people in different ways. So that's actually kind of nice. And the other thought I had was, as thinking about 2021 is that we need to do less but do it deeper. Because I think people have realised the value of authentic relationships, and they'd rather be in smaller number of relationships with fewer people, but better. And I think church can do that, but that's slow work.
Yeah, I think with kind of one stage where we're all kind of longing to get back to normality in terms of being able to sing again, like we're all desperate for that, and being with each other. But I think it has given us a chance to go, I'm not satisfied with just turning up on a Sunday and thinking that is going to give me a spiritual life, and realizing that more people are taking responsibility for their own spiritual lives, and that always has needed to be the case, that we always needed to be able to find people to journey alongside. We needed to reach out and read and pray for ourselves. So I guess it's sort of how do we give people a sort of scaffolding for that as the church?
Yes, but the trouble is the scaffolding word is very systemic or is systematic. It's very organizational. And what we're trying to do is actually cultivate a plant. So I've been struggling with this because what I'm trying to do is get people to become friends with one another in a natural, but it's a natural thing. You can't force friendships. Yeah. So, and I want to be a person who's got time for others. So, because that's clearly something people are valuing a lot, is people paying, you know, actually having genuine time for people. And so that's why I'm saying do less, do it deeper. And we've learned to improvise in this time, the value of just trying to connect people together. But that's harder to kind of write down on a piece of paper and present to a parish council. And it's harder to sort of systematize.
Well, I wonder whether too, where that comes back to your measures in that, like I did when I was in pastoral work, I just found that one of the awful things, having a review and KPIs as a pastor, I just like rebelled against the whole concept. I was like, I'd be writing down my KPIs. People become more Christ-like, like, you know, and if you can tell me how to measure that, good job to you.
That's right.
But I wonder whether this is a chance for us to kind of actually stop putting some of those pressures on pastors that does enable them to live more authentically themselves. I think one of the problems with our churches is that we as churches force pastors into lives which aren't healthy and aren't, that are spiritually dry themselves.
Well, see, there's a massive opportunity here to be a non-anxious presence, to use that kind of cliched language, a hopeful presence in an anxious time, to lead by showing what hope means. But you can't do that if you're really flat chat and really worried and anxious yourself. So we as communities, not just the pastors, but we need the pastors to be spiritually healthy, spiritually full, and as communities we need to be spiritually healthy and spiritually full. So focusing again on, you know, who knew, prayer, deep understanding of scripture and loving relationships with one another. You know, that's our tried and trusted formula. That's what we're good at doing. So we should go right back there.
And I've noticed too, like oddly, as people have been less able to go out of their homes, that I feel like people in church has been connecting in more to the communities around them as they've kind of gone, this is something we're in together. And I wonder whether that's sort of like trying to get rid of that isolationist sort of method of doing church, where we get everyone in doing church programs and we make them afraid of almost the world out there, but rather we need to help people be more embedded in their communities.
Yeah, I mean, this is the tension though, is like you immediately think, oh, what structure can we set up? what program can I make that will make people less program oriented? That's the tension. But I think I'm convicted that I just need to be spiritually deeper, spiritually healthy, know my Bible even better than I did, be more prayerful than I was, and that my congregation, that we as Christians need to be as well. That's the path forward in the midst of chaos and uncertainty with an uncertain future. It's fantastic to have that as a sort of still the eye of the storm.
And I wonder whether that is, like, you know, we've been talking about in the last episode sort of the polarized society and our place as Christians in that. But there is a place to model something, and that what we're trying to do with the project, that you don't necessarily want to engage in the culture wars. What you want to do is show a different way of being community that speaks into the things that people are realising at this time that they're desperate for, that they're desperate for really significant relationships, that they want to think about mortality, they want to think about what the meaning of life is. And none of that comes through the culture wars, you know.
No, strangely, the New Testament speaks into our situation because it does speak into crisis all the time.
Yeah,
in a church that feels embattled and its temptation is to a really fearful response. We've been doing Ephesians in our church, and we got to Ephesians 4 and 5, and it talks about being the children of light in the way we operate our community together and our common life, because God has his purposes, and his purpose is to get a people for himself in Christ, to make them holy and blameless, and to unite them. And so doing our church thing is actually, simple though it is in one level, is profoundly meaningful. It's where the action is.
Almost been like a community within community, that we have good communities in the church, and we also are people who are invested and relational members of the communities around us. Marg and Dave, two people obsessed by stories, but not always the same ones. And it's a bumper Marg and Dave this episode, with our top book for 2020, our top TV series for 2020, and our top movie for the year. And usually we know what we're looking at together, but this time we haven't told each other our choices. Maybe we can try and guess as we go along, Michael. And hopefully you'll also get some ideas for your summer relaxation time. So we're starting with the book.
The book, yeah. Well,
what do you reckon I?
Oh, I don't. I've no clue.
I don't know. Have you gone for fiction or non-fiction?
Well, I've gone for non-fiction.
I thought maybe Dominion for you.
Well, actually, I wrote Dominion down and I've crossed it out because I thought you would say it's going to be Dominion.
Yeah.
However, it is British Empire related.
Oh, right.
So I'll come clean. Yes. It's The Splendid and the Vile by Eric Larson, which is a book about it actually relates to a episode we recorded a while ago because it's the story of Winston Churchill in the Blitz.
Oh.
And it's very similar to the movie we reviewed.
Yes.
We reviewed the Winston Churchill movie. And it actually, although it's written after the movie, it does vindicate a lot of what we see in the movie about Winston Churchill and his character in that extraordinary time. It's a very well-written book. I romped through it in a couple of days, even though it's, you know, hundreds of pages long, 500 pages long or something, and couldn't put it down. And it's very much what was happening in the personal world of those involved in Churchill's circle during the dark days of the Blitz in 1940 and 1941.
Kind of like a crisis book, and you're reading it during a crisis.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, also, it's curiously domestic and political at the same time, which is, of course, how reality happens, in that Churchill's daughter is kind of falling in love and getting married, and then there's an affair with Avril Harriman, who's the sort of the American ambassador, and things are going on in the personal world that are also then affecting how the political world is going. And Lord Beaverbrook, who is one of Churchill's key offsiders, keeps wanting to resign. He's kind of the minister for aviation, and he's minister for all sorts of other things too, and doing a great job, but he just wants to resign. And Churchill keeps saying, no, no, you must not resign. And then, of course, you find out great things like Churchill used to work in the bath.
Which is in the film as well.
Which is in the film. His secretary used to come in and take dictation while he's wandering around with hardly any clothes on.
Did you read this in the bath?
I did not read it, no, in the bath. And then also he was sort of he'd drink a lot, but seemingly able to function, even though he'd have brandy all the time and champagne and
so and then baths and
baths and champagne
is what this is about.
to defeating the Nazis. So he's really used personal diaries and that sort of on the ground evidence to give a very personal impression of what was going on. My parents-in-law lived through the Blitz in London.
Oh, right.
And he describes what it's like to be in Blitz-torn London with bombs raining down just beautifully. What was your book, Megan?
You're not going to guess?
No, I'm not going to ask.
Well, it was also a World War II book, but it was fiction. It was All Our Shimmering Skies by Trent Dalton. So we did a review some time back on his debut novel, which we both love, Boy Swallows Univore.
So this is just new, this book?
Yeah. I just read it like in a huge blitz. And this is what I wrote, actually, after I finished reading it. I wrote on, because I like pretending that I'm a book reviewer on my Facebook. And I said, I finished it and I want to read again. It is a book which has the intertwined depth and beauty of its cover, a fecund cornucopia of metaphor. And it's a perfect story for a moment in which the world is ending. I looked up the genres that it's sort of categorized under. It's magical realism, bildungsroman, historical fiction, coming-of-age story, adventure fiction, war story. It's got a huge amount going on. I think it's better than his first novel, which you enjoyed.
Yeah,
It's magical but yet gritty. It's a quest. It's about how you choose meaning in life. It's about sort of she's always looking up to the sky, hence the shimmering sky. So it's about when you're in the midst of crisis, where do you look? How do you look to the sky? Sort of what's beyond yourself? And she is amazing. It's a teenage girl, Molly Hook, running for her life, but also creating meaning. And it's beautiful. You know, it's a World War II book. It's about Darwin under bombing, but it is a beautiful, beautiful. He's just got such a great way of describing. So I think this will be a fantastic summer read, and it is a really good COVID read, because it's about how do you experience life when the world seems like it's ending.
Oh, that is going to go on my Christmas list. So what about TV? You should probably start with your favourite TV series or TV show. It wasn't The Bachelor, I take it.
No, I didn't. I don't really watch free to air anymore. Well, it was a Netflix one. It was Unorthodox, which we reviewed. I think that was my absolute favourite. One, I think, because music was so integral to it, and singing, and I've been missing singing. But also I really found it, and I think I said that when we reviewed it, such a fascinating connection for me between her Orthodox Jewish community that she's coming out of, and yet I just kept seeing experiences of growing up evangelical. For me, it really aligned with some of my own struggles as an evangelical woman. And yet, while it sort of tore apart some of that legalism, it still did in a way that could see some of the joys and beauty in that community and identify with that as well, and how to find a way forward. So when you watched that one, how did you feel about that as a series?
Well, I felt, I mean, we did an episode on as you said, and I felt there was I didn't relate to it as much. I loved the story. It was great storytelling. I felt like there was a sort of I felt sympathetic to a community that's been persecuted to within an inch of its life, wanting to preserve its identity, and the fact that there's a tension there in the way we think about personal identity between groups and individuals, and that was the tension, a very common tension in Western thinking. And I felt, particularly the Jewish community, where they have suffered so much, that to then sort of complain about them or to kind of critique them in this way is it's dangerous or kind of it's risky stuff. Even though it's problematic with the way they behave and the way they restrict individuals, of course.
So, what was your TV series?
I've just started watching the Crown series 4, and I'm loving. I mean, I loved that. I binge watched the first three series this year, and it's fantastic. And if I'd watched series 4, I might have finished. I might have put that. But I've just also watched The Queen's Gambit, a series again on Netflix.
I'm halfway through that. We're watching as a family, so I'm trying not to get ahead.
And it's a great story. It makes chess exciting. That's what's cool about it. And it's a story of a girl who's an orphan who learns almost by accident to play chess in the basement of the orphanage with the cleaner. And it turns out to be a kind of genius at chess, but at the same time picks up an addiction to painkillers and tranquilizers and then alcohol. And so has this tension going on in her life, that she's a genius chess player, a world beater, and yet at the same time has to figure out how can she do that How could she do that world-beating chess thing without maintaining this horrible addiction? There's a feel-good element, and I got to say, it was a sort of epic which ended well. Sorry, it's a spoiler.
Okay. Well, no, I'm glad to know that. That'll keep me going, yeah.
It's an epic, and I thought, I should ask for something more dark, but actually it's a dark, there's a lot of darkness in it, but a lot of light as well.
A little bit like Unorthodox. Actually, it's a bit similar in that there's that really intriguing central young female character.
Yeah, and someone you can't turn away from as well. Mm. She's sort of a compelling actress, a compelling figure on the stage, on the screen.
Oh yeah, both of the actresses are amazing.
So what about movies?
Movie.
Hope is a dangerous thing.
You have a brother in the 2nd Battalion.
Yes, sir.
They're walking into a trap. Your orders are to deliver a message.
Well, my movie, I'm going to start with that, was the last one I saw at the cinema, which was 1917. Game one we
back
reviewed.
At the beginning of the year.
And I just, I've been a sort of history buff and really into, when I say into the First World War, fascinated by the First World War. Mm. And I thought 1917 was extraordinary achievement of sort of realism, but also just... It's a spiritual movie. It's a movie about darkness, tragedy, hope. It's got hymns of resurrection in it. It's got it confronts us with the worst about ourselves. It's awful and wonderful all at the same time. Who could ask for more?
Yeah, I really enjoyed 1917. I have seen some in the movie since then, but I really love and that, like Unorthodox, a very key moment with a particular song, which
yes,
adored. Yep. I don't know. Can you guess my movie?
No, I can't. No clue.
So I'm choosing a movie that was online, not on the movie cinemas.
The $10 founding father without a father got a lot farther by working a lot harder by being a lot smarter by being a self-starter.
Anyway, Hamilton.
Oh.
Which we've also reviewed.
It was too obvious a choice.
It was. I mean, it was just so much. I just think that is going to be one of the classic musicals of all time. I've not seen anything like it. Just the music is incredible. The lyrics are poetic. It brings in history. It talks to the contemporary moment. I've been listening to the soundtrack again and again and again. It talks about community, but it also has a real understanding of the individual psychology. Like, if you haven't seen Hamilton, like, you know, if you don't like musicals, you should still give it a go.
It's intense, I'd say. It's really intense.
It's really intense. Yeah. I mean, I love that. I love being gripped when I watch things.
Well, it was absorbing. It was utterly absorbing. You had to concentrate and have the subtitles on is my recommendation.
You do. And watch it several times. You've only watched it once, haven't you?
I've only watched it once, but I will be going back to it and certainly listening to the soundtrack. Well, that's been really insightful. I should have guessed all of those from me. But we'd love to hear what your choices for the year are on the Facebook group. So do go on there and we'd love to hear your suggestions for holiday viewing, holiday reading.
Well, coming up next episode, which will be in the new year, thanks for being part of With All Due Respect during 2020. What a year. Our first one episode in the next year will actually look at something coming out of 2020, which is vaccines, because we're all really hoping for one.
That's right. To get the jab or not get the jab. Are there ethical vaccines? Is the community going to vaccinate itself? Are there going to be conscientious objectors? We're going to talk all that through in the new year. So we look forward to seeing you then.
And it's bye from me.
And bye from me as well. With All Due Respect is hosted by Megan Pauldetois and me, Michael Jensen. It's produced by Mark Hadley. The editing is by Nicholas Van Soest. With All Due Respect is part of the Eternity Podcast Network, an audio collection showcasing the seriously good news of faith today. Head to eternitypodcast.com, where you'll find show notes and other stuff related to our episodes. And click on to our Facebook page to join in the debates with All Due Respect.
Brought to you by the Eternity Podcast Network.